Okay, we're here. Welcome to the Ag and Food Finance and Policy Division. We'll call the meeting to order. Just before we get started, a few introductions and other things that we'll have as well. We have a second page now. Lauren Dower, is that correct? So Lauren is here with Dana. Welcome to the committee. And Lauren, where are you from?
From New Ulm.
From New Ulm, okay. So nobody on our committee is directly from New Ulm, but I think many of us have probably been there at different points. So welcome. Happy to have you. We do have a quorum. Let's do the minutes right off the bat, and then I'll introduce a couple of other people. But Representative Brand.
Madam Chair, I move the minutes from March 3rd, 2020.
Members, that the minutes are in your package. Is there anyone who has additions or corrections? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. The motion prevails. The minutes are adopted. So just a couple of other things. Just, you know, like to embarrass people here, but Grayson O'Driscoll, Representative O'Driscoll, serves with all of us. His nephew's in the audience today, so he's interested in hemp. So we're glad to have him. He's going to learn more about it. And if anybody, so Grayson is here, so welcome to the committee. Tom Smoody is here, and we welcome him. He's just in the back there. And if you know that name, he was the AURI 2018 Ag Innovator of the Year, and he makes great popcorn. And so today, I believe there's going to be some popcorn available for us. And I don't know if Tom wants to come down to say hello. You can certainly do that. I don't mean to put you on the spot, but
we always love food.
But since you're here, we're glad to see you. I know that I think you were in the Senate Ag Committee. So if you just want to go to the table and just state your name and just.
Hello, my name is Tom Smoody with Smoody Sunflower Oil. And we've been working with AURI over the last how many years to innovate different products, and most of it's out of desperation when you're a farmer. So so the thing about this popcorn, I'll back up. In 2010, we were looking for a different crop to crush for the byproduct, actually, and to feed our feedlot for cattle for protein. Well, it turned into the oil was the thing that we're going after. So right now we have oil in retail in the small bottles and Cub and Coburn's and Cashwise and all over the five-state region now. And I ran into we have two different businesses, one for selling grain bins and whatnot for farm equipment and the oil. I ran into a farmer over in Mora, actually, that builds a machine to build these bags for popcorn. And we tried for 2 years how to keep liquid oil in a popcorn bag without having wax in that bag. So we took all the fluorocarbons out of the bag. All that's in there is popcorn, our sunflower oil, which is liquid, and salt. So there's no additives, no preservatives in a brown paper bag. And it was very challenging to keep water in a bag, basically. But it's been done, and we're probably over 500 stores now. And it has a really good flavor. It's so white and crisp. And so you guys can try it out and see what you think. The last thing we've been trying now with this year, I've been working with another producer for Minnesota hemp, and we've figured out how to clean up the oil on hemp and put that in a microwave bag also. And it doesn't turn green now. So before we could only sell it on March 15th or whatever for St. Patrick's Day, but it's been, so that's one of the things that we're working on right now. So you guys can enjoy it and go from there.
Well, thank you so much for coming to the committee and sharing your popcorn, and I can attest that it is very flavorful. I've had it numerous times, so thank you. Any questions for Mr. Smoody? Thank you. Very much appreciate it. Members, last month we had a presentation by MDA on the industrial hemp program. You recall that. I know that some people had remaining questions, and there was a lot of interest in that. We had to kind of set some of those questioners aside to be able to complete the meeting. So we're going to have a little bit more of a discussion about that. But before we go into that. We've got Representative Vang has a hemp bill that the department is proposing, and she also will be aided by Whitney Place. So Assistant Commissioner Place will also come here, and then and it is Hemp Day at the Capitol here, Hemp Day on the Hill. So I'm just welcome to anyone who's here to learn more about hemp or is a hemp producer. So welcome to the committee. Representative Vang, you can go ahead and move your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to move my bill, House File 3706, to be in front of the committee.
Okay, so to be recommended to be re-referred to the Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Division. Very, very good. So go ahead and
Thank you. So before I start, I would like to give a quick shout out to my constituent. He is also in the room. It's great to see that since we legalized hemp in Minnesota, this spurred a lot of interest since then, and it's always been growing. And so I'm glad to see that there's a lot of it's growing in popularity. So my bill, House File 3706, is basically making some provisions, industrial hemp provisions modified, definitions provided, and industrial hemp data classified. Since the passage of the 2018 Farm Bill defined industrial hemp as an agricultural crop in the U.S., it opened interstate commerce for hemp products and allows states and tribal governments to oversee hemp regulations. And as MDA began developing their plan to submit to USDA and the rules for the state of Minnesota, some changes to the Industrial Hemp Development Act were identified. First, after operating a pilot program for the last 4 years, which licenses both growers and processors of hemp, it was identified that processing was not explicitly included in the statute. And so this bill adds definitions for applicant, authorized representative, entity, processing location, and processor. This bill also includes processing throughout the chapter where appropriate, including the rulemaking authority. The need to include processing also came from the work on the sale of cannabinoid products work group spearheaded by Representative Paul Anderson last session. Secondly, because the program has been operating under a pilot program for research purposes, licensee data was protected under the Minnesota data practices. So while Minnesota is operating under a pilot program for the 2020 growing season, once the pilot ends, all licensee data will become public. And so the goal of this bill is to protect growers and processing locations and street addresses of the licensees. And I can defer to my testifier, Whitney, to further explain the bill.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee, Commissioner Place, and just go ahead, identify yourself and state your comments, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I don't have a lot to add. I think Representative Vang kind of covered it, but I'm here to stand for any questions the committee may have.
Okay, any questions? Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Question for Ms. Place. As I understand, the USDA and MDA didn't quite agree on rules for this year, so you're operating under USDA rules this year. So does this new bill at all attempt to pacify USDA, or is that a whole separate issue as far as getting your set of rules approved by USDA?
Commissioner Place.
Madam Chair, Representative Anderson, we're in the process of developing a plan to start negotiations with USDA on their approval. This was actually, as we started writing the rules for the state of Minnesota, we identified that, you know, over the past 4 years, we've been licensing processors in Minnesota, but processing wasn't explicitly included in the statute. And so we felt like we needed to add it into the statute to make our rules more comprehensive.
Any other questions? I don't see any other questions. Anyone in the audience who would like to testify in support or opposition? We have a couple of people maybe from the Minnesota Hemp Farmers and Manufacturers Association. Do we have a few people that are coming down? So we have Matthew Kaiser and Sarah Wellington. So welcome to the committee, and if you would just state your name before you begin.
Hello, my name is Sarah Wellington, and I am the founder of the Minnesota Hemp Farmers and Manufacturers Association. We are a 501c3 charitable organization as recognized by the IRS, founded for the education and dissemination of research-based findings for the applications of industrial hemp here in Minnesota to help rebuild a very damaged economy and environment. Matthew Kaiser is on my advisory board, and he and I are very supportive of your definitions in the bill. I think that a working set of definitions and education is really important in this re-emerging agricultural commodity. This is an agricultural commodity, and we need to focus on that as we argue with the USDA in setting what we're looking at. Novel cannabinoids is one thing, and grain and fiber are another. I see Minnesota as being a leader in grain and fiber, from nanotechnology to hempcrete. We can do it here. And I think this committee is where we need to start, especially with research dollars. And I did see a moment for research dollars and access to banking. We were denied again a banking account. So that's my statement. And I'll leave that to Matthew. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Wellington. Mr. Kaiser, welcome to the committee. And just state your name and then begin your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Matthew Kaiser. I'm on the advisory board of the Minnesota Hemp Farmers and Manufacturers Association. Last month, Adam Bells of the Star Tribune wrote about how in 2019, 30 Minnesota farmers filed for bankruptcy, and that the forecast for 2020 is a further 9% reduction in farm income. While the report concerned corn and soy farmers, the predicament our state's hemp farmers are in is not much different. Throughout much of the nation, and especially here in the Midwest, the majority of farmers who grew hemp for its CBD content are still holding on to much of their harvest biomass. There are many reasons for this, but ultimately it's due to a bottleneck in processing capacity combined with a hugely undefined regulatory around marketing, labeling, and testing requirements, which leaves farmers unable to figure out how to market their product. This issue of consumer safety has been of particular concern to our organization. And as a result, we implemented a consumer safety watchdog project where we've been testing random samples of CBD products off the shelves of retail locations within the Twin Cities area for heavy metals, pesticides, molds, toxins, residual solvents, as well as the CBD and THC content. The initial results we're getting back are anything but comforting. It's a poor analogy, but the farmers and manufacturers in the hemp industry right now were building a plane and flying it blind. The labeling laws that went into effect this year for pharmacies are a great start. However, it seems that the majority of consumers are purchasing CBD products from places other than pharmacies. These types of standards need to be applied industry-wide and are a constant request we hear from the public. Without guidance, the sale of hemp and CBD products will be stifled, and farmers in Minnesota will continue to suffer. The same issues are going on right next door in Wisconsin, where the Department of Agriculture stated on February 20th that 94% of the 2019 harvest has still not been sold or processed. We applaud the efforts by legislators to offer more clarity and guidance on these issues and are largely supportive of the findings from the sale of certain cannabinoid product work group. But we're concerned that the continued focus on non-intoxicating cannabinoids comes at the expense of programs and incentives to help build an industry around the fiber, food, biofuels, building materials, and all the other 100-plus products that can be made from the other 90% of this plant. Our concerns are based on the growth of industrial hemp processing facilities such as the Hemp Hardwood Facility in Tennessee and Hemp Decortication Facility in Texas. Minnesota was once one of the top producers of hemp fiber in the country, and we urge our representatives here and to help our farmers regain that lead by spurring the growth and development of hemp beyond just CBD. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. I don't see any questions. Thank you. Representative Vang.
Yes.
Any concluding comments?
Nope. I would like to thank the committee for hearing my bill and for your support, and I would like to renew my motion that House File 3706 be recommended to be referred to the Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Division.
All right. That motion is before us. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. The motion prevails, and the bill will be referred to Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law. Thank you. So we are going to continue the discussion a little bit on industrial hemp. We've had some comments then by testifiers, but we have Anthony Cordelette is here again today. Last time we had some people that had questions. I There were four members on the list at the time. It was Representative Lippert, Representative Eklund, Representative Keel, and Representative Hamilton. And this was a while back, so you may or may not recall what your questions were. So I'm opening it up to everybody. You know, we had the reports that was done in the past, and we had that conversation, but I don't know if Mr. Cordelette, if you have any introductory comments or questions to spur our own questions, that would be appreciated. Anything?
Madam Chair, no, I'm just here to, it was 2 weeks ago, so just to answer your questions.
All right, perfect. Well, we'll start, we'll just kind of go down, and Representative Lippert, maybe you'll be able to spur some additional questions, but go ahead with yours.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Cordelette, I do remember my question. It had to do with processing. So I believe you said that there was no processing for industrial hemp in the Midwest, or just very limited amounts of processing in Midwestern states. And I'm curious what the obstacles are to having more processing, and how we might move options for processing forward interstate.
Mr. Cordelette.
Madam Chair, Representative. No, there is processing for hemp in general in Minnesota. I think the case that Mr. Smoody was here today, and we can process grain, we can process cannabinoids. The problem is with the fiber, and I think our last testimony kind of showed or demonstrated that. The closest fiber processing we had up until a couple months ago was in Nebraska. I believe that company may have moved to Tennessee now. That brings a big burden to Minnesota farmers who are going to bale up hemp stock for fiber processing, put it on a truck or a train, and have to send it out to a company somewhere else in the U.S. As was pointed out, you know, Minnesota had the lead in, was a leader in hemp processing, fiber processing prior to prohibition in the 1950s. Fiber processing is probably the most expensive type of processing to reestablish, because the decortication of hemp requires a lot of inputs. And so, you know, we thought about how do we get folks interested in coming to Minnesota and investing in some type of a processing plant. How we do that right now, I don't know. It seems we've talked with some investors and they're looking for money. And obviously the Department of Ag doesn't have money to give out to investors right now to develop those expensive fiber processing plants. But I believe if we could start getting fiber processing located around the state, you would see more farmers switching over to growing hemp for fiber. And right now it's probably our least grown crop in the state in terms of what we license.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Lippert, anything else more?
Well, it just, as you're talking, it's occurring to me that seems like we have an opportunity, as was mentioned earlier, to be a leader in grain and fiber, but the processing is a huge obstacle, and so we should be trying to think about how we can make that possible, make that accessible, for moving this forward. So,
thank you. Representative Eklund.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Cordelette, I retired from the paper industry, and hemp was way back in when was a component to the paper industry. So we have several paper mills in northern Minnesota that are always looking for a fiber supply. Has the conversation been talked to about that with those groups? Because some of them are both groundwood, some of them are the black liquor pressure cooker type process, but I would think if you're having a fiber issue and getting rid of fiber, that might be a way to take a look at it.
Mr. Cordelette.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative Eklund, that's a great point. And we have had conversations kind of on the periphery with some folks in the paper industry. One of the big benefits, obviously, is that hemp fiber can be mixed into the current wood pulp system that we have. But the other thing that's important is anywhere there's plantations with high-producing poplar that, you know, you're waiting 7 to 10 years to harvest, you could have an annual crop of hemp in those same locations and be producing fiber for paper every year instead of having to wait for those stands to mature. Obviously, there's, you know, it becomes an agronomic issue. You have to have inputs then every year and so on and so forth, but you can also put folks that would want to farm in more of a row crop fashion up in that neck of the woods, so to speak, into more of an agronomic position to, you know, expand their farming businesses.
Representative Eklund.
And thank you, Madam Chair, and thanks for that answer. I do know that there is a potential process that is looking up in the Birchdale area. So, I mean, there may be something happening. I don't know if you're aware of that one, but there's been some inquiries, and people are looking to do what they can do with their farmland up there. So thank you.
Thank you. Representative Keel.
I think my brain doesn't remember, but I have a question now.
Oh, perfect.
You know, all this discussion about the fiber, how are we developing better ways of harvesting fiber? That seems to be such a challenge for my guys up in my district that and maybe it was a wet year and that's why. But and then when the fiber is baled, is it combustible like what's it called? Hay.
Straw.
Well, straw is too, but I have a neighbor who had a whole bunch of hay go up because it burned because of the moisture. So I'm just wondering, is it in the same type of thought?
Mr. Cordelette.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative. One of the issues in our state is we haven't had enough folks experimenting around with fiber. We've had a very limited amount of production. However, the fiber is being harvested in Canada as well as other states around us. There are challenges to new farmers coming in to, you know, retrofit equipment, but it can be done to cut and bale. It's been done here by several growers. In fact, in our first year, one of our growers actually dual cropped, where they can crop for grain, harvest the grain heads off, and then cut the plants, remaining three foot of stock, and they baled those up and sent them down to Omaha to Bascor was the company, and they decorticated some fiber out of there. I haven't seen any issues so far in our state or neighboring states with the burning or fire aspect of it, but obviously if you dried your bales, you know, to a certain point, that can happen with any type of material like that. But we're hoping that's one of the reasons it's kind of a chicken and egg thing. We'd like to see more growers start adapting it here in Minnesota just so we can see what happens here with our annual precipitation, our growing conditions, and so on and so forth, to figure out how it's going to be, that industry is going to look like here in Minnesota, and what issues farmers are going to deal with. Obviously, fiber, even if you're harvesting for grain, is a challenge because the fiber in that plant wraps around everything. So you talked about bales going up in flames, but we hear a lot about combine fires if you're driving a little too fast, so it's definitely not corn and soybeans. You got to slow down a little bit. But those are the kinds of things that I think Minnesota farmers want to be able to put more acres in to learn how to deal with these issues.
Thank you. Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Chair Poppe. One of the testifiers earlier brought up the issue around banking. Can you speak to that and what needs to take place to overcome those challenges?
Yes.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative Hamilton, that's a great question because within the last year, I think I've spent more time with the Department of Revenue and Commerce talking about this because that's certainly something that's coming on to their radar for giving loans out. It's like any other agriculture. Farmers need loans, especially to start a new industry, as the first question today pointed out. The banks have an issue because of the specter of it also being a controlled substance if it goes above a number. And that's challenging because to put a loan out, for example, on a crop, they may want to take security interest in that crop, but they're doing the loan now, this time of the year, and then the department's got to go out and test it, you know, in let's say July, August. And if the crop goes above 0.3, according to the rules as they stand now, that farmer, that crop's worth nothing. So if the farmer went bankrupt, for example, or somehow went south on their loan, the bank would have nothing to put their, you know, security into. Now, that's just one example, but that's the kind of issues that banking are trying to figure out so that their interests are protected too. And I think it's getting figured out. I think there's younger bankers that are coming along today in small towns that are willing to take that risk because they like money, you know, and there's money to be had in this, and there's a great opportunity. I mean, hemp is growing. So it's just an issue of working around this whole, well, it's legal if it's hemp, but it's a controlled substance if it goes above that number, and that's really where we're at right now.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Brand.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Corlett, I don't believe that we had this conversation last time you testified there, but 1 in 10, or a little bit over than 1 in 10 people that grew hemp last year failed, and their crops were destroyed. I know that we have a lot of control over who grows, last year's background checks. Now we're talking about licenses. We'll still continue to have those field tests. What can we do as an agency to provide guidance to people to limit that even more, to tighten that up a bit more? And then my second question is that average? Is that normal to have 1 in 10 farmers with failed crop, or is that a bit high?
Mr. Cordelet.
Madam Chair, Representative Brandt, that's the, you know, million-dollar question or issue. It's our biggest issue, I would say, with the USDA rules. What we've learned, our first 2 years of this program were truly industrial hemp, grain and fiber. Those varieties don't fail. They've been genetically, genetically grown to be below that 0.3 threshold. That's where the number 0.3 came from. Because those varieties were what commonly was referred to as hemp. Because of within the last 2.5 years, the marijuana industries in Colorado, California, Oregon have expanded to take advantage of the definition of hemp and say, hey, we can't operate outside of Colorado, for example, but we can go to all these hemp states now and we'll just grow non-psychoactive. And they're growing back with marijuana plants and sometimes feral varieties or hemp varieties, and those genetics are unstable. So to address your question directly, what the department's trying to do is tell growers when they get involved in this, it's a high risk to grow for any cannabinoid extraction. And unfortunately, because of the kind of gold rush that's been created with the need for cannabinoids or the demand for cannabinoids in the public sector, that's where farmers want to go. They're being told, hey, you can make $10,000 to $80,000 an acre. If you grow for cannabinoids, that's hurting our fiber and grain industry. And so that creates, it's just a multi kind of dimensional problem here. We can't really provide any protections to a farmer when they buy their seed in the spring and they're told by some grower in Oregon, oh yeah, this is guaranteed not to exceed 0.3. There's no way to know that. One of the solutions that we tried to put forth to USDA was remediation so that we could give a scale above 0.3 where we could allow either a grower to just strip the flowers and the leaves, which, by the way, the Controlled Substance Act does not consider those controlled substance and never has, or to allow them to mix it down or just to test final product. Why are we testing in the field when we know they're going to go extract cannabinoids and jack the, you know, 0.3 is going to go up to 1% to 3%? I think the problem is USDA is new to this. We've had 5 years of experience trying to build this industry. We've had 2 years with cannabinoid extraction. All of the failures are occurring with those cannabinoid extracted plants. I can't give you a national average. It's all over the place, but I can compare it to Arizona where they had 40% failure rate. And the one thing I guess I would ask of this body is if you can help us in any way, help farmers. The worst part of my job is trying to call somebody up that didn't intend to grow a controlled substance and they're at 0.7. Mm-hmm. No one is going to sell cannabis at 0.7 for anything other than a hemp use. Until you get up past the 3%, Mark, realistically, you're looking at negligible THC, and we're punishing farmers for that. And until we get genetics figured out, We need some way to help them. And I would say that's one of the biggest issues that farmers deal with, is that insecurity, along with banking and, you know, processing.
Representative Brand.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for that, those answers. One question I have is, if I'm a farmer and I'm starting out with this process, I don't really know where to start. And so oftentimes when I buy my seed, I would go to the Nicollet elevator or the Traverse elevator and talk to the people there. And if they're selling this stuff from Oregon, or another state like where Arizona had grown theirs and had such a bad fail rate, is there something that MDA or somebody else can do to kind of blacklist those growers or those seed distributors to say, no, that will not work for the requirements here in Minnesota, or to kind of give some training to the folks who sell at the elevators to say, hey, look, you know, if you're buying these seeds for growing in your district or your counties, rather, these growers or these seed producers are failing at a high rate. Is there something we can do to kind of diminish that? I mean, I can't imagine that many farmers are seeking this stuff out on purpose. I'm sure it's all accidental, but with 1 in 10 sinking money into seed, spending that time growing the product, and then all of a sudden finding out in the middle of the harvest or the middle of that process that you've got something that's going to turn into nothing, mm-hmm. and there's no remediation from the federal level or the state level, I got to be wondering if that maybe causes some people to pause when we should be really thinking about the potential for this industry and how much we could do to benefit our local economies.
Mr. Cordelet.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative Brandt, I couldn't agree with you more. One thing, well, there's two things I want to point out about that. The last year was really our first year that we had failed anyone. Prior to that, there were no failures. And that was because of the influx in CBD growth and all of the genetics coming into the state. The good news is that we are building more of a seed industry here in Minnesota. There are a few growers that are starting to now grow. We have good associations. One of them testified earlier. Farmers are networking. They're using their associations to educate themselves. We're starting to have folks from the University of Minnesota reach out to us and get involved from education and extension standpoint, so I'm excited about that. I just think for the first couple years it was kind of looked at, well, this is just a pilot program, and a lot of people didn't take it seriously, but the farmers were. And now it's grown to a level with the 2018 Farm Bill passing over a year ago where it's nationally, you know, accepted, and you're seeing a lot of interest in it. But now it's also exposing all the bottlenecks we have. So, you know, the department has been so focused on just licensing and testing fields and trying to make sure that fields are compliant. That takes a lot of our time. It would be great to be able to do other things. I know there's been a couple reports that have been submitted to the legislature this year on specific to cannabinoids, but they're relative to hemp. And I think that committee, I was one of the members on both of those, but the folks pointed out that there's a lot of different regulations federally and state. There's all kinds of agencies that are involved in this and that, and they're not necessarily all talking to each other. And that's not really necessarily a criticism. That's just the way things work. But we need to break those barriers down too, because farmers get stuck in the middle of all of this, and they're lacking the information they need.
Thank you. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would just add that the farming can be a risky business, and if a farmer's going to take a chance on growing a crop that grosses $80,000 an acre, he better realize that there are risks involved in that. My question to the testifier, Mr. Cordelet, we talked about acres of hemp grown. It's also being grown in greenhouse situations, I would assume very high intensive capital type thing, and I would also assume that's being grown for CBD production. Have any of those facilities had product that's been tested to be too high in THC?
Mr. Cordelet.
Madam Chair, Representative Anderson, yeah, they have. And in fact, CBD is grown outside and inside, or cannabinoid extract, plants are grown outside and inside, but obviously inside's better because you're protecting any pollen drift. Where outside fields, that can be challenging. I don't know what the percentage to outside fields versus indoors has been. One thing that started to happen, though, when we did, especially the indoor growers learned this early on, because those were some of our first failures because they were growing this time last year and they had their first harvest, is to, you don't have to necessarily let, you know, if you think about corn, you want the best yield you can get per ear of corn, right? So you let it mature to its full growth. You might not want to do that with these hemp varieties. You need to have somebody that can test your crop weekly, potentially, to let you know where those cannabinoids or where the THC is getting to, and you can harvest early. And so the industry as a whole is kind of adopting this. Sometimes they have to harvest early so they won't destroy their crop. So, for example, the numbers are somewhat misleading, or maybe not misleading, but you can look at them multiple ways. Yeah, we had 12% failure rate, but a lot of those folks that failed were growing multiple crops, and they didn't fail again because they adopted that short-term growth. So that kind of strayed off your question. But, yes, it's there's just as probably many failed inside as outside.
Thank you. I don't see any other questions. So thank you for the – oh, I'm sorry, Representative Lewick. Sorry.
Thank you for the additional information. I guess one thing that intrigues me is we've gotten pretty good at genetics on things like corn, beans, and other things that we can literally very quickly analyze a particular seed. Are we doing any research in that area for this product? Because it seems to me that to try to stop this thing before it goes really south on you, if you know and it's predictable what that seed is going to perform at, I mean, you know, if you get Roundup Ready and non-Roundup Ready beans mixed together, it's a disaster. Who's doing research on that, if any? Because that looks like something that we need to really maybe turn the screws up on.
Mr. Cordelette.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative, that's a great question. Dr. George Weiblin, who's been in front of this committee many times at the University of Minnesota, has been doing some genetic work that we've helped to fund at the department, where we were trying to look at isolating the genetic markers that would allow us to take DNA out of seed and be able to determine what the probability would be, if not necessarily what's going to happen with that bag of seed, but at least be able to put something on the label for the grower to look at to see what the probability of it going hot or not would be. He's still working on that with his lab. We've had some other professors reach out to us on other agronomic aspects, not plant breeding so much anymore, and that's kind of where you were sort of alluding to. There is work going on nationwide. The fact that we're not the only state that has failures, this is, you know, basically ubiquitous across the U.S. hemp states. So there are some people making claims this year in advertising, like in Ag News and other, like, legitimate agricultural magazines and websites and stuff, which is a little different than how it was last year, where they're really putting their skin to the game by doing that. And they're claiming that, you know, our varieties will produce hardly any THC. So a lot of their research is being done privately, so it's proprietary information they're not sharing. But I think this year is going to be a big tell how the genetics jump forward. And I think we are going to see some of those cruddy varieties, for lack of a better word, start to get displaced. So it is happening.
Thank you. All right, now I see no more questions. So thank you, Mr. Cordelette. I appreciate you coming forward.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Give us the opportunity to ask those questions. So now we're going to move to House File 3533.
Chair Poppy, move the bill.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move that House File 3533 be recommended to be referred to the Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Division.
Okay. And you may begin and introduce your testifiers.
Yes. What I will do is just kind of briefly go through the bill, and then I have an amendment. So I just want to make sure that people, that we do both.
Sure.
This is a bill that updates the statute to reflect actual practice. The county recorders are people that work in every county, and they sometimes are behind the scenes, and you don't really know the things that they do, but they are always looking to update things and make sure that actual practice is what's in the statute and in the books, so we want to do that. And one of the things that the reason why this bill is in front of us is because this has to do with the Farmer Lender Mediation Program and having the form available. Right now it states that the county recorders have that form available, so if somebody would go, that's where they would seek the information. And when in actuality it is the University of Minnesota Extension Service that provides the form and does that. So that's the bill, and then we have the amendment, and the amendment was drafted. Mr. Sullivan is very skilled at his job, and he was able to kind of go through and say, well, here's some other areas that we need to update based on what we were initially doing. So instead of in the amendment where it talks about agricultural and to replace that with Minnesota Extension. So just so again, it's the most accurate reflection of who we're dealing with and what the process is. So that is the bill. I have the amendment, and I would also like to move that amendment, which is H3533A2.
Perfect. We have the A2 amendment before us. All those in favor? Oh, sorry. Yeah, you have a question. I'm sorry. Representative Anderson, go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a question here. The amendment actually is longer than the original bill, so is this a DE amendment?
Thank you, Representative Anderson, Mr. Chair. It is not a DE amendment, but I'm going to ask Mr. Sullivan to just describe why it's longer.
Mr. Chair and members, the amendment's long really because the sections of statute that are amended in the amendment or modified in the amendment are themselves long. In each area of statute that is applicable under the Farmer Lender Mediation Act, there's quite a bit of language, including the actual language that needs to be in the mediation notice that the creditor provides to the farmer. So that ends up taking up quite a bit of space. So that's the reason why the A2, which is not a DE amendment, is pretty long.
Okay. All those in favor of moving the A2 amendment, signify by saying aye.
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 All those opposed, say nay. Okay. The A2 amendment's been adopted. So present the bill, introduce your witnesses, and continue.
Thank you. So I know that I have Betty Camels here from the Brown County Recorder, and I'm just going to turn it over to her, and she can, both of them would be able to speak to the issues and, you know, why this is important to have this bill.
Great. State your name and begin with your testimony.
Good morning. I'm Betty Camels, the Brown County Recorder in New Ulm. And I'm here representing the Minnesota County Recorders Association from the Legislative Committee. And I do believe it was covered quite clearly. The practices, the forms have never been in our office. We're not knowledgeable in the background of it. And it's just nice to get it out of the statute and just eliminate it. So if you have any questions, I'd be glad to answer them.
Thank you. Are there any questions for the members? Okay. And then you have another testifier as well.
Yes. If she wants to testify as well, she certainly may.
My name is Mary Schreiner, and I am Betty's chief deputy at the Brown County Recorder's office, and I've worked with her on the legislative committee, and I'm co-chairing the subcommittee of housekeeping.
Thank you.
Thank you both for being here today.
Mr. Chair, I just also want to talk about the repealer, because that's kind of an interesting also update, and I think it should be in your packet at the end. So it talks about astray, not a stray, but astray animals. It's a new word that I didn't even know existed, but it means if you do have a stray animal, people would go previously to the county recorder to identify that they had located a stray animal. And now, you know, you see postings all over Facebook and Twitter and whatever, and, you know, it's, we've advanced so much further that there's no longer that need to actually go through that route to have it, the county recorder know about that. It's we have immediate reaction when somebody loses an animal or if it's gone somewhere. So that is, that's also being repealed in this bill.
Very interesting. Is there any member of the audience who wishes to testify for or against the bill? Okay, seeing no one. Member questions? One more time. Okay, Representative Hamilton.
Is it still on the books where the commissioner has to go out? I believe personally get feral hogs. Is that what it was?
Mr. Chair and Representative Hamilton, I believe it is, and I don't think we would ever get rid of that one.
I agree.
Thank you. All right. Any further discussion? If not, would you like to renew your motion?
Yes, I would. I'd like to renew the motion that sends House File 3533 as amended, that it be recommended to be referred to the Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Division.
The motion is before us. All in favor signify by saying aye.
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 All those opposed, nay. The motion prevails, and the bill is referred to the Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Division.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Thank you. Thank you. Next, we have House File 3739, Representative Lippert.
Representative Lippert, please move your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move that House File 3739 be laid over for future consideration.
And thank you, Representative Lippert. House File 3739 is in our packets, and if you can go ahead and with your information about the bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, we've discussed many times in this committee the crisis that many farmers are in currently. We know that many farmers are in crisis due to low commodity prices, high input costs, volatile weather conditions. There are a series of bills that have emerged from farmers that seek to respond to this current crisis. These bills include more money for farm advocates, allowing farmers in debt mediation to pay a flat $100 per month fee or premium for Minnesota care coverage for their family, and then this bill that provides loan fee grants for farmers in mediation to assist them in restructuring their debt through FSA. Backed loans. In 2018, 3,500 farmers were referred for mediation. 3,500 farmers were not able to pay their bills and had at least $15,000 in debt that was being called by the bank. Approximately 1,200 of those farmers entered mediation. 85% of those mediations were successful, but that means that about 180 farmers or 180 of those mediations failed. Farm Service Administration data says that from 2016 to 2019, the FSA's withdrawn or denied loans ranged in number from 105 to 155 annually. The average amount of those loans was roughly $350,000 each of the 4 years. So this bill comes forward with the assumption that the withdrawn and denied applicants and those failed mediations could be served by a program which would eliminate closing costs and fees for farmers that are trying to restructure their debt and move them into FSA-backed loans. Those fees are 1.5% of loan value, or around $3,000 to $5,000 on average. So that would be a $3,000 to $5,000 benefit for a farmer in mediation looking to restructure their debt. We think this is a concrete way to respond to the farm crisis and help more farmers get through the mediation process. And with that, I'll invite other testifiers to come forward today.
All right, so we'll begin. Welcome to the committee. So Mr. Sobosinski, if you want to begin.
Thank you. My name is Paul Sobosinski. I'm a livestock farmer. I also work with the Land Stewardship Project. I'd like to make two pieces available to the committee before I start my testimony. One of these pieces is a farm crisis statement that our organization put together with our members. Another is a graph and a look at the mediations here in Minnesota, comparing now to back in 1986 when the farm crisis was at a height, actually starting in 84, but legislation happened in 1986. This morning, I'd like to lay a little context for this bill, and that's as it relates to the farm crisis statement that our organization worked on with, we developed with 40 of our members, held series of about 6 or 7 meetings across the state, and we just did a final piece of that process in Mankato with about 170 farmers and supporters of ours that turned out for that meeting, and a meeting with our Commissioner of Ag, Tom Peterson, and our Attorney General. So the bill that we're advancing here today is we're looking at a series of policy recommendations due to the farm crisis that Representative Lippert spoke to. And in terms of the farm crisis statement, a couple pieces just to make note of is the farm income is at a disastrous level. And while our state policy recommendations, which is on the second page, get at parts of the pieces. These are some recommendations that we're suggesting to the state and other recommendations we have in here. Not everybody will agree on all the solutions perhaps that we offer, but we offer them in sincerity about doing something about the farm crisis. My history about working on the farm crisis goes back to 1984, 1985, when I was part of forming an organization called Minnesota Groundswell that worked in the crisis. I see extreme similarities to them. And one of the results of our work that we did in Minnesota Groundswell and working with other organizations at that time, we got a number of solutions that were achieved in a bipartisan effort. So the number of bills that we're advancing, we're trying to advance them with a bipartisan spirit. And that action back then resulted in, like having mediation, the Representative Poppy you just spoke to today, resulted in having a farm advocate program. That resulted in getting an interest buy-down program. And while interest rates are lower right now, we need different tools in the toolbox. Farmers need different tools. It's great to provide farmers with counseling, but if you're giving farmers counseling, you got to do something to relieve the pressure. And this bill that Representative Lippert's offering, along with a number of co-authors, Representative Hamilton, Representative Lewick, Representative Gunther, and Claiborne, Papke, and Vang, we want to say thank you to all this bipartisan spirit, and that's what we think is important to move forward, to start to get at some of the pieces, provide some tools in the toolbox, that when a farm advocate is sitting down with the farmers in financial trouble, they have some tools to help them. Because this is the toughest time, I think, that we're seeing right now at this period in time. It's important we move forward. Thank you for the opportunity to testify this morning.
Thank you, Mr. Chobosinski. All right, Mr. Miller. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
You just state your name before you begin your testimony.
Dan Miller.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me. And thanks for considering this bill and inviting me here today. My name is Dan Miller, as I mentioned. I farm about 800 acres near Spring Valley, just south of Rochester, with 2 adult sons and a daughter. 3 of my 6 kids are still in high school. We do grow conventional corn, oats, soybeans, and alfalfa. Part of the farm is also certified organic. We do raise Angus cattle. I grew up on a dairy farm, went to UW River Falls and the U of M, and serve as chairman of the board of the Midwest Forage Association, and alfalfa is our third major crop in Minnesota as well as nationally. I also served as an extension educator in Redwood Falls for the University of Minnesota as well as the University of Wisconsin in Price County. But for the last 30 years, I've taught farm management with MinSCU first in Fergus Falls and then more recently now in Spring Valley. Excuse me, through Riverland Community College in southeast Minnesota. Yesterday, myself and 40 of the roughly 60 farm business management instructors met all day at South Central College in Mankato to help compile farm business management data for the southern aspect of the state. And of course, we put together those numbers annually in a publication. But we also join that data with statewide data with the University of Minnesota Farm Financial Management area. And next week, we will compile the statewide data for the FinBIN online farm information from around 2,300 Minnesota farms that is used by farmers, lenders, agribusiness, policymakers, and others to make decisions. While we don't have those final numbers yet, we should in a couple weeks. But we do know that the last 6 years have been very difficult for Minnesota farmers. Net farm income in 2019 was about half what it was in 2013. So, and also the debt to asset ratio was around 40% in 2013. So on average, each farmer had about 40 cents of debt per dollar of asset in 2013. Today it's about 50%. So it's about 50 cents of debt for every dollar of asset. So equity or net worth as a percentage has diminished. Due to cash flow challenges, farmers are refinancing short-term debt and re-amortizing it long-term, secured by their largest asset, farmland. The problem in the last 6 years is a result of farm product prices being less than the cost of production due to no supply controls, perhaps in the dairy farm or the dairy or the federal farm policy, as we have had basically since the Great Depression 1930s, and also heightened recently by the loss of some export markets associated with steel and ag trade wars and retaliatory trade tariffs. The market facilitation payments, some characterized as the Trump-China trade payments, which in my county, out of 87 counties, I'm in Fillmore, were $54 an acre last year, which significantly helped in 2019. However, they are not guaranteed for the future, so can't use them to plan on or put in a cash flow or anything like that. The farm crisis of the 80s was similar but yet different. The energy problems of the 70s with OPEC, Arab oil embargo, and gas lines created high inflation in 1980 to curb inflation. The Fed raised interest rates. It was very hard on farm borrowers. However, farmland values, of course, are very, very sensitive to long-term interest rates. Consequently, farmland values dropped from 81 by 86, they're about half the 81 value, so they drop in about half. Farmland is about 70% of most farmers' balance sheets as far as an asset, so net worth and equity plummeted and lending and financial problems occurred. Minnesota had an interest buy-down program in the 80s, where if a farm operating loan was at 4%, if the lender reduced it by 2 points, the state jumped in and picked up the other 2 points, which was helpful in the early 80s. Interest rates, of course, are historically low right now, and as a result of the, as a result of the coronavirus issue, of course, the Fed just dropped another half a point 2 days ago to stimulate the U.S. economy. The coronavirus issue will not help our efforts to export Minnesota farm products and actually would likely make a bad situation slightly worse. This is impacting a lot of the farm families, of course, throughout the state. The whole family is affected. Of course, female farmers are actually the largest growing demographic we have in the farm sector. Over half of present FFA, Future Farmers of Ag, and Agriculturalist members are girls, for example, and farmers will need to lead the effort to solve the current climate crisis. Healthy, abundant food is inexpensive. Farmers have little control, however, over the input costs, product prices that they receive, or weather, so they are more vulnerable than most businesses. Risk is large. Of course, that leads to stress, which we you know, leads to stress, and we need to do a really, really good job with the variables that we can control and affect our business, as there are many variables linked to success we cannot control. And as Ted Matthews mentioned yesterday at our group meeting, he's the farm psychologist, explained that to us in the meeting yesterday, if we dwell too long on factors outside of our ability to control, we may really become cognitively unhealthy. So, you know, this bill is a tangible, one tangible way that hopefully isn't a budget buster, that we can perhaps keep and help some of the most vulnerable farmers stay on the land farming and be a benefit to them. Farmers with good skills and abilities were largely caught in a bad way due to really three problems: timing, timing, and timing. They just bought assets or made business changes and just got caught in a tough time. Or even if they didn't make changes, the narrow or negative profit margins of the last 6 years have weakened them financially. So that if we can help with loan origination fees on some of the most vulnerable farms as they refinance to position themselves to better weather this tough Minnesota farm macroeconomic time, I think I would highly encourage it. I did talk to Brian Hartman, who is the FSA lending leader for Minnesota this morning, just to kind of go over it. One example would be if a person, and I talked to a client of mine, a dairy farmer this morning, who's actually going through this exact same thing. But if they had $100,000 and they were going to have a guaranteed still stay at the bank through FSA, it was $100,000, you know, they'd guarantee 90% of it, they'd guarantee $90,000. And they would be charged 1.5% loan origination, which is $1,350. So that's one small but yet way that we can perhaps be a benefit to them. So thank you for having me, and I would urge you to consider the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Miller. We do have one more testifier to come down. Stu Laurie had signed up and like to testify on this bill. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chair Poppy and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Stu Laurie. I'm the Government Relations Director for Minnesota Farmers Union. And I'll be brief. I think Dan gave great testimony, but just wanted to share our support for this legislation and eliminating a barrier that would allow farmers the opportunity to restructure. You know, this is an issue that I've heard from our MFU members about, and you know, I talked to a member this morning who was talking about his own experience with mediation and the origination fee, and even just the emotional barrier and the kind of psychological barrier that he had to overcome in taking on more debt in order to restructure his existing debt is kind of you know, difficult and probably results in some folks not taking advantage of that option. So I think this could be a positive change, and also support adding RFA loans to be eligible. That's something that, you know, I think because we've had so much attention from this committee and the legislature, been hearing from a lot of members who are thinking about RFA and how that might help them restructure their finances and make it through this tough economy. So thank you so much for the opportunity to testify, and happy to share our support.
Thank you, Mr. Laurie. Members, any questions? Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Maybe this would be a question for the loan officer. Is he a loan officer? I think. Anyway.
He's FBM instructor.
FBM instructor. What's the difference between a USDA loan, of course, that's federal, in the RFA loan program, which is a state? Why would you choose one over the other?
Mr. Miller.
Good question. Of course, yeah, FSA, of course, is federal, and RFA is state through MDA. There are differences. This is what we're talking about here basically is the federal guarantee program. So the federal government guarantees 90% of the loan. So if they default, you know, the most the bank can be out, let's say, is 10%. So and it, it doesn't cover the USDA direct loan programs, which they do have. But they do not charge an origination fee on those loans. They just charge a credit report fee, $45 or something. And then the RFA loans are different. They are not guarantees, but they are direct loans, and they typically do they're typically a shared loan where the RFA provides 45% of the funds, and another entity such as a bank would do 55. So they're shared loans, direct loans, however. So this is dealing with the FSA guarantees and the costs associated with that.
Representative Anderson.
Thanks again, Madam Chair. Well, the bill has a net worth limit of $800,000 to be eligible, but I would assume somebody who's kind of underwater with their loan situation would not have an issue with the net worth being too large. So my question is there an upper limit of loans available from the USDA, those FSA loans? How large can they get?
$1,776,000. Okay. I confirmed that with Brian Hartman, USDA, this morning.
All right, and maybe Mr. Sobosinski has some comment about that.
So the RFA piece is taken right from that net worth piece is taken from the RFA. Is a piece that you've adjusted over a number of years.
Yeah.
Okay.
Representative Anderson, anything else?
Yeah, thanks, Madam Chair. Just a little confused about why we would use this for both a federal loan program and a state loan program. The RFA loans are wonderful, and hopefully today on the House floor we're going to get mm-hmm. get that bill passed and get funding back again there. So, no, just kind of wondering about using the two loan sources for a state program.
Thank you. Any other questions? Is there anyone else in the audience who wanted to testify on this bill? I don't see anyone else coming forward, and I don't see any other questions. So Representative Lippert, House File 3739 will be laid over for future consideration. Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Thank you.
For this opportunity for the conversation.
Thank you. And then I believe we have nothing further on the agenda today. But we will have a bill up tonight that hopefully everybody will be ready for. It's the RFA bill. So happy to move that out of the House and get that over to the Senate, and then they can act on it hopefully early next week. So I appreciate everybody's time today, and have a good weekend.
Madam Chair, I'd just like to say thank you for the popcorn again.
Tom Smoody is the man of the hour with the popcorn. So thank you, Mr. Smoody. And with that, meeting adjourned.